Inez Stettman.
I'm Will Chamberlain.
I'm Amber Duke.
I'm Ben Weingarten.
And this is NatCon Squad, where common good and common sense meet. NatCon Squad is produced by the Edmund Burke Foundation, the home for national conservatism. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Okay, so per usual, we have a great lineup of topics to discuss today. I'm going to kick it off to talk about some of the developments in the battle between Texas and the federal government in terms of who has the power to enforce the border. We're going to then move to the Biden Bucks legal challenge from Pennsylvania. We're going to be talking about, and that's going to be Ben's topic. And then we're going to move to Will. We're going to talk about Trump's bond and the reduction of that bond. And then finally, we're going to fill out that roundup with Amber talking about the abortion pill case in the Supreme Court. So with that, I guess I'll turn it over to myself. So this is an ongoing case, and we've talked about this before, and it has a lot of different aspects and a lot of different procedural elements flying back and forth. So I wanted to provide an update simply because I think this actually does have, as I said when we discussed Arizona against the United States several weeks ago, this case coming out of Texas has the potential to really transform the landscape for states in immigration, especially for border states, in a way that would transform the immigration policy of the United States. Because the background and the backdrop to all of this is, of course, the complete abdication of duty to enforce the border in any way whatsoever from the Biden administration and the federal government as a matter of policy. And we all saw that viral video from the New York Post about earlier this week going around where actually you have Texas National Guard holding back essentially a horde, and that's the right word, of young men who are trying to force their way through multiple gates into Texas, into the country, and they're actually overrun by like this huge crowd of potential migrants who are trying to get into the country. That video went viral, and then of course that was followed up with a story that the Biden administration hasn't actually even bothered to file paperwork in more than 200,000 asylum cases. Now, recall, most people claiming asylum in this do not have a case for asylum under the law. They're just clogging up the system and hoping for a court date that's, you know, 3-5 years out where they can disappear into the country. So not filing paperwork almost always means that somebody who has no right to be in the country gets to continue in legal limbo in the country and functionally be inside the United States. So the Biden administration has not even bothered to file their half of the paperwork saying that these people do not qualify for asylum in these cases. And that's 200,000. So that's the backdrop, right? We know that this crisis is increasing and getting worse nearly every week, that it is a crisis that's now touching basically a huge range of communities in the United States, from red states and border states to finally blue states, which is why we're starting to get even some Democrats like the New York City mayor, Eric Adams, complaining about the impact that this huge wave of migrants has on the United States, on law and order, on budgets of municipalities, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All things that Hidalgo, Texas has been complaining about and being called racist for decades. So that's the backdrop. Texas passes back in December, it passes SB4 among a series of border measures. So last time we talked about Texas putting up a razor wire and the debate in different levels of the courts about putting up razor wire. This is about making it a misdemeanor in Texas to be illegally in the state, right? So essentially stacking a misdemeanor on top of illegal entry into the United States and then independently enforcing it through the state. So it comes with jail time, about 30 days to 6 months of jail time for people who violate this Texas law. And it ends with deportation back across the Mexican border, which, by the way, the Mexican government is saying they won't participate in. And that's a whole other story. But this law is not contradictory, right, to federal law. It is merely sort of doubling up and making it an additional state crime to be in the state of Texas while having crossed the border illegally into the United States. So that's what all of this is about. And so it's been bouncing between different various issues that don't touch the merits, which really have to do with who has power in this situation, whether the federal government has the kind of plenary power that can completely push out even concurrent state action, or whether the states have some limited ability to enforce and to pass sort of parallel laws like this and to do some measure of enforcement on their own. And we've talked about the merits of the case before, but there's been some developments. The Supreme Court basically kicked this back to the Fifth Circuit, which I'm not going to explain the long procedural posture of this, but basically freed Texas to enforce SB 4. But then immediately that evening, a three-judge panel from the Fifth Circuit once again put a stay on the enforcement. So as of now, this law is not being enforced, but the merits of it will be heard in the Fifth Circuit before it eventually finds its way back up to the Supreme Court on the actual merits of this question. But I bring this up in part because last time a lot of people were doom and gloom about Amy Coney Barrett on the merits, on the basis of this procedural back and forth. In this case, she's on the other side of the procedural back and forth. She's kicking it back down to the Fifth Circuit and saying, actually, you know, until, you know, the Fifth Circuit has full power to deal with this, and Texas can enforce that law until the Fifth Circuit tells them not to. So in this case, she was on the other side. So I really don't think, regardless of how this case ultimately shakes out, I don't think we should read too much into some of these procedural battles and where that indicates where certain justices might be. But it also, I think, again, highlights the potential of this case if on the merits Texas can prevail, both in the Fifth Circuit or in, you know, ultimately in the Supreme Court. Even in part, if they can prevail even in part, it will open up an entire new arena for state power and legislative action on immigration that I think wrongly was basically taken from the states in Arizona against the U.S. We have a very different court composition than we had. We have some great dissents in that case from some of the conservative justices that are currently on the court. This is a prime case for this court to overturn and give at least some modicum of power back to the states to enforce it. And again, I think this could transform immigration enforcement in the United States, because let's be honest, even under Trump, right, who did his best with these executive tools to try to enforce the federal law, our federal immigration law is broken and has been for 30 years. You know, the American people have continually put it on politicians' radar that illegal immigration is a massive problem, that lawlessness on the border is a massive problem, that drug smuggling is a massive problem. And Congress hasn't fixed the law. It hasn't fixed our asylum law, so it's not so easy to take advantage of, for example, one of many, many examples. But the states that are actually dealing with the most consequences from this, if they can get a measure of that state power back, we might see, for the first time in 30 years, some real enforcement on the border, even if it is piecemeal. And obviously, ideally, the federal government would be doing this, but I really do think it has some potential to break through the legislative stalemate on the federal level and allow these border states to exercise eminently sane policy that prevents them from having, you know, millions of people who are not legally in the country streaming in, you know, causing law and order problems, causing enormous resource drain on a lot of these municipalities and on the states themselves, and obviously causing huge cultural problems for the residents of those states. So empowering them to do something about it, I think even the potential of that could be huge. So sorry for taking so long. This is a complicated case and posture, but I do think I'm going to continue to provide, I hope people enjoy it, because I'm going to continue to provide updates every time there is a major update in this case, because I think it has such huge upside potential for an issue that has been so frustrating and stagnant in the United States for the last 30 years. Sorry, throwing it out to you guys now.
I'm a fan of, hopefully this, you know, the Supreme Court does the right thing here and finds a way for, you know, Texas to be able to enforce its own immigration law. I got to say, I'm pessimistic about that. I don't think Amy Coney Barrett is on the right side of the sort of federal versus state issue. I mean, obviously there's federal preemption. So when the federal government legislates, states can't contradict that. But this distinction between the White House's non-enforcement policy versus the desire of the states to, you know, enforce what should be binding immigration law on everybody. I think the right answer there is to allow the states to do that. But I can't say I'm optimistic about that, because I you know, obviously we're going to lose the three liberals on that. And I'm not sure that Barrett and Kavanaugh or Barrett and Gorsuch somehow will come out the right way on this.
I think it's interesting as well that in this previous Texas case involving the concertina wire, that when SCOTUS came down and said the feds did have the authority to remove it, the National Border Patrol did not, DHS did not. They decided to leave it be because it was basically an opportunity for them to punt their own enforcement authority to Texas, because the Biden administration fundamentally doesn't want to enforce border security. So they were able to continue to kind of make Texas the bad guys, even though they could have gone in and cut the concertina wire. I could sort of see a similar thing happening here, where if this does come down on Texas's side, that the Biden administration just sort of lets it go and allows them to, you know, do whatever they want to do in Texas, while they can say, you know, see, for their progressive base, see, we're still not touching the border. But ostensibly, Texas could help reduce some of the numbers.
So first, just on a matter of politics and optics, it's really striking to me that it's a compelling message, a disturbing message. But the two kind of bookend images of the Biden administration are Afghans running for their lives after Biden's calamitous effort to pull out of Afghanistan, and then these quote unquote newcomers trying to rush the southern border and attacking American authorities. Those are two compelling and I think representative, but also disturbing images that should be politically potent and resonate, I think, with the American people. We'll see in November if that's the case. But on first, I guess, on if and when the Supreme Court ultimately takes this case up, which it almost assuredly will at some point, I'm at this point still licking my wounds from Murthy v. Missouri, and but not just as a consequence of the way the, you know, just kind of how the justices were going to shake out and how the swing justices themselves comported themselves in oral arguments there. One of the big takeaways for me sitting in oral arguments was just, it is a total away game for the states going up against the feds, the states or anyone else going up against the feds in that venue. And you have to believe that all due deference is going to be given to federal authorities here. Securing the border is a federal charge, and you know, the states try, though they might, to defend the public health and safety of their citizens. I imagine that the feds are going to put forth, you know, an onslaught of arguments against and say that the states are kind of usurping the powers not lawfully delegated to them by the federal government. We'll see. Maybe some justices will prove a surprise, but it strikes me that is the ultimate away game for states and non-federal entities going up at the Supreme Court. All that said, what Texas has done in basically hitting the federal government with a barrage of policies aimed at defending the American people, where the feds are derelict, and not only derelict, but systematically eviscerating sovereignty and encouraging invasion, they have to be applauded for those efforts. If nothing else, it forces the federal government to react and show the American people its true colors. And beyond that, I guess what I'd say is, why isn't every single state with these kinds of interests following in Texas's footsteps? It's a no-brainer on the politics and the merits as well. And I think, you know, the question that needs to be put to the Supreme Court is, what are states supposed to do when federal authorities are derelict and our citizens' lives are threatened, life and limb is threatened? Hopefully the Supreme Court is forced to actually grapple with that question. So on that note, I guess we're going to transition to Will now to talk about Trump and this bond reduction.
So yeah, the news came out yesterday that in his New York civil trial, or the New York civil case rather, the Judge Engoron had set his bond at $450 million, and the Court of Appeal reduced it to $175 million. It's a big deal for Trump. That's a big reduction. It's almost about a 60% reduction, maybe a little more. And it makes a big difference in the context of an appeal bond, because from my understanding, these, you know, unlike other bonds, you don't get to put up real estate as collateral for an appeal bond, because these companies have to then put up the money and don't want to worry about selling highly illiquid real estate. So they want liquid securities. And so even a person with as much paper wealth as Donald Trump doesn't necessarily have $500 million in cash and liquid securities on hand, given that most of his wealth is tied up in real estate. So it's a big deal for him. It means he can pay the bond. It significantly reduces the fee he'll have to pay, to the bond company, because usually that's going to be a percentage of the total bond. So it's a good day for Donald Trump to see it go down. That said, it just shows the ridiculousness of this case. I mean, you think about, you know, normally we think about trials, and I mean, even juries can be pretty suspect in places like New York, where they're predominantly leftist. But here you had, basically, there was no victim. It was the decision of two people to try and ruin Donald Trump and his finances. It was the decision of the Attorney General, Letitia James, and it was the decision of this one New York judge, Judge Engoron. And the two of them, one bringing the case and one making the judgment, were able to, you know, create a, you know, impose a legal judgment on Trump for $450 million for fraud that had no victims whatsoever. And, you know, there was this New York Times article that came out yesterday that said, you know, they may be able to seize Donald Trump's properties, but it's hard to know what they're worth. Well, gee, that's the entire premise of the case that you just brought, that you know what they're worth and that you know Donald Trump is wrong. And I mean, but then they found that Mar-a-Lago is worth only $20 million, when in the context of Palm Beach real estate, that's a ridiculously low valuation. I mean, if you've ever been to Mar-a-Lago, some people have. It's a massive, massive property. You know, if Palm Beach is this large barrier island that goes down the Florida coast, not many properties cover the entire width of the barrier island. I think Mar-a-Lago is the only one in all of Palm Beach, which is notorious as one of the highest dollar value real estate markets in the country. So 20 million is just, you know, peanuts in that very context. And yet they found that it was worth 20 million. And on that basis, they said that Donald Trump defrauded all these extraordinarily sophisticated New York banks in order to get a loan that he later paid off. It's not a theory that they can actually explain well, and that has obvious, like, you really think that Deutsche got essentially ripped off or defrauded by Donald Trump, when they also almost certainly have sophisticated real estate investors? They don't. But we're in this world where the result that should come out, if the rule of law was being applied objectively, is not the one that you can guarantee will come out, especially in the context of Donald Trump. We live in a world where already the rule of law doesn't work when it comes to partisan prosecutions, when it comes to prosecutions with any sort of political significance. And I'm glad to see the appeal pond get shut down. I hope that this augurs something good for President Trump when it comes to actually the merits of the appeal, that they'll throw out this case. But, you know, there's still plenty to worry about. Also, the fact that he's about to, you know, 2 to 3 weeks away from a trial in New York, a criminal trial in New York, that also has its own massive legal flaws and shouldn't have been brought. But anyway, curious what you guys think of the bond reduction and, you know, whatever else is going on with Trump's legal problems.
I think this is at great cost for Donald Trump, because you can imagine he cares a lot about his wealth and his buildings. I do think this has the potential to be positive for him, only because this is something people understand, that essentially the DA of New York wants to expropriate his buildings because she doesn't like that he's running for president. I mean, that bluntly is what's happening. As Will correctly laid out, this case there is basically no real estate developer and investor in New York that couldn't be caught up in a case like this. These are sophisticated financial actors on both sides. You know, Deutsche Bank expects that Trump is going to, you know, inflate his assets as much as possible to get the best possible loan. They're going to do their own investigation. They're not that dumb. They don't take what their clients give them on face value. This is all very much normal transaction, apparently, for this kind of loan. And in fact, Letitia James and other New York politicians, and there's been quite a bit of sort of gossip scuttlebutt and reporting about the fact that they've had to calm down a fair number of their own donors in the Democratic Party in New York City, because basically they're looking at this case and saying, I could be in this case, right? You know, and so they're freaking out and thinking about moving their assets out of New York. And so, you know, the city is having to do behind the scenes, basically say what is obvious up front, which is, we're only doing this to Donald Trump because we don't like him. We haven't concocted this bizarre way of using this fraud statute in which there are no victims specifically for Donald Trump. And I wonder what impact things like this have. The fact that, you know, you have James licking her lips and publicly saying, like, yeah, I've got my eyes on 40 Wall Street, right? I do wonder how much that affects that consistent polling that you hear about people who say, well, they'll consider voting. They don't really like either candidate. They'll consider voting for Donald Trump, but not if he's convicted of one of these crimes or under one of these lawsuits. I don't know. There are these two competing narratives, one of which is obviously true for the purposes like of what we believe on this show, which is that Donald Trump is being unfairly prosecuted because of his political views. And this is essentially unfair. And then there's the second narrative for a lot of people, even people in the middle, who say, well, there must be some smoke under all this fire. If there's, you know, five cases filed, well, then he must have done something wrong. And I think incidents like this push a lot of those people a little bit backwards in that when it's so public and so obvious, and this is something concrete that people can understand. They are literally trying to take his skyscraper. So I think it's more concrete, and I think it has the potential to backfire politically.
Yeah, I tend to think that the sort of specter of legal trouble floating around Donald Trump and the rhetoric and sort of all those negative externalities that people view when they think of him are sort of baked into his support or opposition. I think whether or not he gets convicted is not going to have a huge effect. I mean, we even saw Chris Sununu, who was supporting Nikki Haley in the primary, saying that he would still vote for Trump even if he were a convicted felon. And to your point, Inez, about how this is affecting New York real estate and businessmen, Kevin O'Leary of Shark Tank has been very loudly all over Fox News and Fox Business talking about how ridiculous this case is. And that's not someone that you would expect to just come out and be like the biggest Trump supporter on earth, but he is acknowledging this for the sham that it is. And I think it's important when we look at all of these cases together and all of the different, basically legal back and forth that's been going on, whether it's delaying the case, for whatever reason, because documents were failed to be turned over, in the New York Stormy Daniels case, whether there was a delay because Michael Cohen was caught basically perjuring himself in the civil fraud case because he admitted that he wasn't really pleading guilty when he pleaded guilty to falsifying documents, whether it's in Georgia, where you actually have the top prosecutors essentially on trial themselves for their inappropriate relationship. All of this combined tells you that the process is the punishment. They're trying to make it as onerous as possible for Trump to run for president. It doesn't really matter to them whether or not they secure a conviction. So they will go 10 steps beyond what is legally necessary or just so that they can sort of tie both him and his finances up as much as possible to prevent him from running effectively for the president.
Yeah, just to echo that final point, just to defend himself against a complete sham of a case, he has to put up $200 million almost, plus legal fees, plus all the attendant opportunity costs, financial and political. And again, to deal with a case that would have never been brought, presumably, had he not been running for president, where there is no underlying crime and there are no victims. And Tish James, who's built nothing in her life, is trying to seize properties from a political opponent, break and bankrupt him. And where's the recourse? And the recourse is you still have to go in front of a likely a hostile judge within the state or judges within the state. And then maybe you'll get to appeal this to the Supreme Court down the road to the extent they don't ultimately dismiss the case. It's amazing that we're at the point, and it's such a commentary that we're at the point where, well, we sort of acknowledge that the rule of law has been obliterated, at least in New York, but there might be a short-term political upside of some kind of bump in the polls because people see it for what it is. If that's where we're at, and I think it is where we're at, it's just an astounding commentary kind of on where the country is and where we are as sort of a post-constitutional republic at this point. And to that point, you know, I'd love to see the justices try to twist themselves in knots defending this on constitutional grounds when this is obviously excessive bail in a no cash bail state where people who will hit you over the head with a brick or stab you get to walk free the next day. But there's no crime and there's no victims here. And they're trying to bankrupt Donald Trump because he has the gall to run against them. Utterly absurd and un-American on every single count.
thought Ben was going to transition to himself because that's where we're going.
Yep. So I guess picking up on the first segment where we were talking about Texas and its efforts to fight back against a derelict federal government, there's an interesting case that Fred Lucas at the Daily Signal recently reported on. He's been on top of these issues for several years now, regarding some state legislators in Pennsylvania striking back at both the chief executive there, Governor Josh Shapiro, as well as President Joe Biden and a slew of heads of federal agencies to combat a series of policies whereby both the state executive branch and then the federal executive branch, these legislators believe, have usurped powers that rightly belong to the legislator when it comes to all things elections. At the state level, this automatic voter registration effort that the governor is seeking to impose and implement in the run-up to the 2024 election. And then for purposes of this segment, and I think maybe more importantly for the nation, efforts to challenge Biden's executive order 14019, which we've discussed before. This is referred to by many conservatives as Biden bucks. What this executive order does is it pledges every single federal agency, regardless of how salient registration and mobilizing voters is, to undertake whatever efforts they can to register and mobilize voters in advance, of course, of the 2024 election, including in tandem with so-called third-party groups, the vast majority of whom who backed this executive order and who supposedly have been consulting with the administration on the executive order are progressive. Some of them sort of try to put up a facade of bipartisanship or we're just defending democracy. But essentially what this looks like to conservatives, and I think on the merits, rightly so, is a President Biden administration controlled get out the vote effort using the entirety of the resources of the federal government, largely targeting voters who in their interactions with the agencies that are seeking to get the voters registered and mobilized are going to have a propensity to vote Democrat. And there are some activist groups out there who say that under this order, if fully implemented, it could basically increase the voter rolls by up to 3 million additional voters. It's also worth noting that the administration itself, in putting forward this executive order, quote unquote, affirmatively advancing voting rights, speaks to the imperative to target, quote unquote, underrepresented voters. So you have, for example, the Department of Education, and they're trying to use federal funds to get students to get other students to register to vote. We've seen a variety of uses from HUD and HHS to try and turn their interactions and their entities at state levels into voter registration and mobilization centers. And we have almost no details about how this is being implemented except through FOIA requests, because the Biden of myriad agencies who have been FOIA'd, and there's even been litigation on this, refuse to turn over their strategic action plans as to how they're implementing this executive order. So with all that background, some Pennsylvania legislators are challenging this executive order on a variety of grounds. They say that it's invalid within the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and federal agencies acting in conformity with it in this suit are in violation of Pennsylvania law on the Constitution. They want the court to decide whether Executive Order 14019 is unconstitutional under the electors and elections clauses, and they seek injunctive relief prohibiting the president from implementing the executive order. They say in their complaint that the executive action taken by the president nullifies the votes of the individual legislators, nullifies the enactment of the legislator, violates the electors clause, elections clause, deprives legislators of their particular rights, and jeopardizes candidates' right to an election free from fraud and abuse. And they identify all the ways these voter registration efforts from the federal level are already influencing and interacting with state voters within Pennsylvania. This case was brought, I believe, back in January of this year. A Trump-appointed judge is presiding over the case in a Pennsylvania district court. And supposedly there may be some movement on this case, according to counsel for the plaintiffs, within the next 30 days or so. So this has the potential to really upend potentially efforts that look like partisan get-out-the-vote efforts masquerading as expanding voting rights for all efforts via the massive resources of the federal government, as opposed to what we saw in the 2020 election with Zuckbucks, where you had private financing of election administration towards seemingly partisan ends. So this is a fascinating case, I think, that hasn't necessarily gotten a lot of traction in the media. It is, as far as I know, and as has been reported, the only such case challenging Executive Order 14019. So I guess I put it out to the group. What do you think about this case sort of on the merits? Should other states be bringing similar action? And do you think this is going to have an effect on a general election where, by all accounts and according to all polls, Donald Trump is polling better than he ever has since he's been a candidate in terms of the swing states as well as overall, but you have these countervailing forces of left-wing entities doing anything and everything they can to manipulate the electoral system and try to juice Democrat votes?
I guess I'll jump in here. Not only do I think this is really a worthwhile sort of legal avenue for Pennsylvania. I mean, this isn't just Biden. Blue states have been doing this sort of thing, by which I mean applying public resources to get out the vote efforts that are clearly partisan for a very long time. It's a favorite tactic of a lot of teachers unions, using like public time and public resources in the public schools to try to get people to vote a certain way and to come out to vote for certain candidates. It's a scam. Like it is illegal, or it ought to be illegal. And it is inappropriate for public functions and public money to be used essentially to bolster one side. And I do think this is, thanks for bringing this up, Ben, because I wasn't following this story at all. Like you say, there was the private component to this in 2020 with the Zuckbucks, with contracting with private companies ostensibly to get out the vote efforts, but then because of the way that they're deployed in terms of the precincts, you end up getting numbers like, you know, 83% Democrats touched by this versus, you know, 17% Republicans, right? And there's a really, really clear bias in who they are trying to get out to vote. That this is, you know, this is the public version of that, which is one step worse in some ways, but also I think easier to legally fight. So I'm encouraged to hear that Pennsylvania is doing exactly that.
Yeah, the story, I also was not as aware of it. So thanks for bringing it on the show, Ben. And it's very striking considering the Democrats were trying to go through Congress to enshrine all of these federal changes to the electoral system, which they, of course, dubbed their voting rights bill, and Vice President Kamala Harris was supposed to be in charge of implementing it. And it would have similarly given a lot of power to the so-called nonpartisan, nonprofit voting rights groups, as well as make a lot of changes to statewide elections on the federal level, to basically ban voter ID and get rid of all these other seemingly reasonable regulations on voting to make sure that there's no fraud in the system. And it ended up failing, thankfully. But what does it really matter if the federal bureaucracy is stepping in to make sure that these changes get made anyway? So it's a good reminder and a great look at exactly how these bureaucracies work behind the scenes and quietly to implement some of the things that would normally have to be passed by Congress, and how it makes it sometimes harder for people to even realize what they're doing when it's not enshrined in law. It's just a bunch of bureaucrats doing it on their own volition at the, of course, behest of whoever the executive is.
Yeah, I mean, speaking as someone who very recently worked for the state of Florida, and had to live under the restrictions that state employees live under, which include you're not allowed to engage in political activity while you're on the clock. Stuff like this is really annoying. I mean, for example, you know, I know that a bunch of Governor DeSantis's, you know, people at the executive office of the governor went to Iowa and knocked on doors for him in the run up to the Iowa caucus. Every single one of them took annual leave to do that. Right. As a state employee, you get 3 weeks or so of annual leave, and every single one used leave to do that. And during the day, you don't get to talk about politics on the clock unless it is directly related to, you know, the official actions of the governor and the Florida government, for example. So the fact that you have massive amounts of public money being used for obviously purely political purposes, and just nobody blinks at it. It's just something they do and, you know, claim, oh, this is nonpartisan, totally targeting get out the vote operations at, you know, blue areas. It's just a general nonpartisan civic goal to help increase the number of people voting. Get out of here. Totally ridiculous.
With that, we'll transition to our last subject, Amber.
Thank you. Yes. So as we record this podcast on Tuesday, the Supreme Court is hearing oral arguments in a case involving the FDA's approval and then subsequent removal of safety restrictions surrounding the abortion pill, mifepristone. And this case was first brought in an attempt to basically strike down the FDA's first approval of the abortion pill back in 2000-ish, because the argument from groups backed by the Alliance Defending Freedom was that the FDA basically did not give adequate research to potential safety problems surrounding the abortion pill and didn't even have the authority to approve it for sale at that time. And as this case has made its way through the courts, it's been a bit more narrowly tailored to recent removal of safety regulations in 2016 and 2021. And that is likely what SCOTUS is going to rule on and what the arguments are going to be centered on around this week. But basically what the FDA did is in 2016, they expanded the limit for when during your pregnancy you can take an abortion pill. So it used to be 7 weeks, they expanded it to 10 weeks. And then in 2021, amidst the pandemic under the Biden administration, the FDA basically said that the pandemic restrictions were preventing women from being able to access abortion. So we are actually going to make it possible for you to have a virtual telehealth visit with your doctor, and you can get the abortion pill sent to you in the mail. You never actually have to go in person and get a checkup from a doctor before you get an abortion pill. And of course, the plaintiffs in this case, who are now the defendants, as the FDA is arguing to be able to go back to the 2021 lack of restrictions on mifepristone in front of the Supreme Court, they say that this is really hurting women's health because of a variety of factors related to the abortion pill that actually make it quite dangerous when you're taking it without a doctor's supervision. I mean, first of all, even just going back to the original decision to make this to make the abortion pill available for sale, the FDA really didn't have good data on the serious adverse effects or potential for death for women who are taking this. The Charlotte Loser Institute has a great breakdown of how the FDA could potentially be undercounting serious adverse effects by as much as 95%, as well as pointing out that there's some other international studies that are much better because, one, they have centralized medicine, so they're able to track women more regularly and further along into and after their use of the abortion pill, that finds that the safety risks are much higher than the U.S. estimates. One of the FDA studies that it relies on to claim that the abortion pill is safe lost as many as 15% of its subjects, for example, from the inception of the study and afterwards. And even then, between 2000 and 2021, when they decided to get rid of the in-person doctor visit as a requirement for getting prescribed the abortion pill, there had been 26 deaths, as well as 97 ectopic pregnancies that occurred or were missed because of women taking the abortion pill. And keep in mind, these 26 deaths and 97 ectopic pregnancies are before the FDA got rid of that requirement for women to see a doctor in person. The FDA doesn't even require at this point people who prescribe the abortion pill to keep track of serious adverse effects unless it results in the death of a woman. So they're not even tracking data anymore on the relative safety of this pill. But I mean, there are so many reasons why you would want a woman to have to actually see a doctor in person before taking an abortion pill. I mean, I mentioned ectopic pregnancies. This is when a pregnancy basically implants itself in the fallopian tube. It never gets its way into the uterus. And if you take an abortion pill when you have an ectopic pregnancy, not only does it is it not effective because it can't terminate the pregnancy because you have to have a surgical removal typically of the implanted fetus or fertilized egg. But you could also confuse the symptoms that you're having from your ectopic pregnancy with symptoms from taking the abortion pill, such as heavy bleeding, cramping, nausea, fever, et cetera. And so some women might delay going to the hospital to get treatment for what could be an ectopic pregnancy because they're going to assume that they're just going through an abortion. If you don't get an ectopic pregnancy removed or treated within a certain period of time, there's a very high risk of serious infection or death. It's a very, very serious syndrome and occurs in about, I think, one in 50 pregnancies for, or not one in 50, I think it's like one in 500 pregnancies for women, but it's higher than people realize. The other issue is that if you're not going in person to a doctor to one, make sure you're pregnant in the first place before you take an abortion pill, but also to determine how far along you are. Some women are taking these pills much later into their pregnancies, second, third trimester, which increases the risk for complications as well, increases the risk of infection, of hemorrhaging, of bleeding for months afterwards, of having to go in for actually surgical removal of leftover baby body parts or even the placenta. Because when the baby gets to a certain stage of gestation, the abortion pill is basically not strong enough to complete the abortion. And you're also not properly screening women who might be getting an abortion under coercive threat of a partner, for example, who is pressuring them to go through with an abortion or threatening to go through with an abortion. It's a lot easier for women to be subject to those circumstances if they're getting a mail order abortion pill than if they're actually going into a doctor's office and expressing their desire in person to want to go through with the abortion. Some of the doctors who have consulted with ADF and the lawyers arguing against the FDA removing these safety restrictions have said that they're quite sure that the FDA has been undercounting the serious adverse side effects because they only, even before they got rid of the requirement for abortion providers to report serious adverse effects, they were only counting a couple of different categories like transfusion, sepsis, ER visit, and infection. Whereas these doctors point out that there have been a number of emergency surgeries they've seen, bleeding for months, anemia, intrauterine infections, and other things that wouldn't even be counted by the FDA. And so therefore naturally make the safety, it makes the abortion pills look safer than they are. So the Supreme Court's going to hear this. I think that it seems like they're probably pretty amenable to the position of the Alliance Defending Freedom and the other the group that is actually arguing against the FDA on this case, because there's so much data available to show that there was really no good argument for the FDA getting rid of these safety restrictions. And then one final point is that the New York Times actually has an article out today about Erin Hawley, who is Josh Hawley's wife. She's actually going to be the one arguing in front of the Supreme Court. And this New York Times article sort of laments the fact that she is not this stay-at-home trad wife and that she actually is as accomplished and quote-unquote powerful as her senator husband. And it's, I think, sort of the Amy Coney Barrett part two of the media being quite disturbed that a right-wing or conservative woman doesn't just stay in the home and can also have quite a fruitful career herself, especially if that fruitful career is damaging to the left's goals. So it's a very interesting case. I know that the ADF and its associated lawyers feel very confident about it, but we'll keep an eye on it, of course, and a decision will come down probably this summer.
Yeah, of course, kudos to Erin Hawley, who is a former colleague, incredibly sharp procedural administrative lawyer. And that's what this case will be decided on. This is an APA case, Administrative Procedure Act case. And you might ask why all of the things that Amber were talking about, you know, the science of the pill and itself and like, what are the side effects and, you know, whether or not you need to go into a follow-up. These seem like they're matters of fact and debate within the scientific community. It doesn't really seem like a legal issue. Well, I want to highlight the fact that we're talking about this under the APA because we've replaced the political process. We replace democracy and a combination of you know, democracy and certain rights and structures that are guaranteed by the Constitution above and beyond and on top of democracy and democratic will, right? We've replaced that system in the case of agencies with the APA, which replaces democracy with public comment, notice and comment. You have an opportunity to weigh in. Of course, if you are one of the small handful of people who are even aware that the FDA was considering dropping this regulation, right? So instead of voting on a moral issue in your state, it's now a like expert-only weigh-in process where you write a little note and then the agency has to consider all of the points brought up by the quote-unquote public, and they have to give that full consideration and they have to provide reasoning for why they went ahead with the regulations the way that they did. And that's what this litigation is under. So I wanted to take a step back and explain that because like, that's not how our system is supposed to work, right? We have this drug that has both scientific consequences, medical consequences, and has a moral valence to it. And instead of discussing that as free citizens in our states, we're talking about, you know, the Supreme Court having to dig through all of this scientific evidence on both sides and decide whether the agency properly considered the reasoning of this study or that study. You know, that's not the court's, it ought not to be the court's job. It is now because we have the APA and we've curtailed all of these you know, actual democratic processes and constitutional processes that are supposed to guide. This is, I just want to point out how absurd it is that, you know, the nine justices of the Supreme Court, very, very smart people. They're very, you know, good in their fields for the most part. But their field is not to read through a bunch of studies and decide what's reasonable and what's not reasonable for the agency to do. They have to do that because we have gotten so far away from the way that the constitutional system and the democratic power of people to weigh in on moral questions in their states. We've gotten so far away from that system that this is kind of our backstop. We have to have a bright lady like Erin Hawley argue this case under the APA in the Supreme Court. So that's like, again, I know that we can't endlessly say Rubicon, that we would just say that all day, every day, as Ben pointed out, you know, in some of the other segments, right? We would just keep saying how horrible it is that our justice system is weaponized and all of this. But, you know, this is a structural problem that's been a long time coming. And I'm glad that this case is being brought, but it shouldn't have come to this at all, because this is not how our system is supposed to work.
I don't have any thoughts on this particular topic, so I'll leave it to Ben.
I would just say briefly, reading some of the scuttlebutt, I think oral arguments might have ended as we're recording this. Take Axios for whatever it's worth, but it has come out and said that it's not clear that there's a majority to come out against the feds here. We'll see if that's ultimately the case. Supposedly Justice Gorsuch, and this wouldn't be the first time this term, but has brought up his skepticism of universal injunctions, which, by the way, I think is more than merited, but he seemed skeptical there. Supposedly Justice Barrett questioned whether or not doctors could come to a decision of their own volition and essentially questioned the litigation itself. My take is twofold quickly. One, this court, when the Donald Trump administration pursued decisions via executive agencies that the court didn't like because it was Donald Trump doing it, they struck down on APA grounds. I'm thinking, for example, of the census citizenship question, which the court acknowledged it was perfectly constitutional and legal for the Trump administration to reinstate a citizenship question on the census. But they said that the process the administration used to reinstate the question was flawed, and so struck it down on those grounds. I think we'll probably see a double standard here to the extent there's broad deference given to the FDA and its decision-making process. And then the other point, just to echo Inez, is what unifies our segments, in every instance, everything goes to the courts ultimately. And that is not healthy for society because it means our representatives, the legislative branch, isn't actually making the decisions and calling the final shots ultimately. It's always going before a judge. And beyond the fact that it speaks to the heavy litigiousness with all of its downsides for a society, it also speaks to the undemocratic and unrepresentative nature of our system now, where everything goes before the courts.
And with that, we're going to move to final thoughts, and I'll take the prerogative of going first. As we're recording this on Tuesday morning, or I guess early afternoon, this morning, there was a terrible accident. Apparently, there's no indication so far of foul play, but Francis Scott Key Bridge on the loop outside of Baltimore, 695 Highway, which is a major, huge bridge. I've gone over it many times. I'm sure my fellows have as well. That bridge completely collapsed due to a ship that lost power and then hit one of the columns of the bridge, sending cars. Fortunately, it was 1:30 in the morning, so traffic was light, but still sending quite a number of cars into the water below. As of now, we don't have casualty reports. There are still 7 people missing is the last report that I was able to find before we started recording this. So obviously our hearts go out to the families of people who were potentially affected and hurt or even killed by this terrible accident. There does seem to be, once again, this symbolic nature of decline, these kinds of massive accidents, bridge collapses, right? The CEO of Boeing resigning over all of the problems that company's airplanes have had in the air that have resulted in, you know, near catastrophe multiple times. There is this pervasive sense that stuff just isn't working the way that it used to. And especially in this, the name of the bridge, Sir Francis Scott Key, obviously the author of the Star Spangled Banner, zero chance that when this bridge is rebuilt, it will be named after Francis Scott Key. That's another aspect to this. It's unimaginable that the state of Maryland would name a bridge after the man who composed the Star Spangled Banner and not over some, you know, instead of some like modern person who probably checks all the right, like racial grievance boxes. So all of that together with, of course, the potential loss of life and injury makes this a very depressing incident to wake up to this morning. So once again, our hearts go out to the families and we hope that everybody is found okay, but this horrible accident.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. And as I'm from Maryland myself, and it's just horrible to watch. And you're right about the Francis Scott Key point. They tried to rename Tawny Town a few years ago via petition because it's named after the late Judge Roger Tawny. And unluckily for them, Tawny Town is in part of deep red, sort of central Western Maryland, and the residents weren't having it. This bridge is outside of Baltimore, so it seems more likely that they would be willing to go along with the name change process. My final thoughts are going to be on this debate that happened over the weekend of whether or not the former RNC chair, Rhonda McDaniel, should have been hired by NBC News to be a political contributor. And I see Ben laughing. Maybe that was his final thought, too. But I think it's been a fascinating study in the decline of media and its rejection of the idea that journalists should fairly cover both sides or at least listen to the other side. They sort of all had this loser meltdown, internal revolt over her even being hired. MSNBC, their president has come out and said that they actually don't even want Rhonda to appear on any of their shows, which leaves the NBC original programming, which is Meet the Press, Nightly News, and the Today Show. She clearly did not make any friends in her first appearance on Meet the Press, where Kirsten Walker sort of just grilled her for 10, 20 minutes about her past work for the RNC. And then Chuck Todd, the former host of Meet the Press, apologized to Kirsten Walker for having to interview her and said that his bosses also owe her an apology for having to do the crime of actually doing journalism. And I think that this is a sign of something that I write about in my book, which is behind me there, Snowflakes Revolt, about how the media has really been infiltrated by woke millennials who just reject basic journalistic principles in favor of using the media as an expansion of their activist platforms. And now the class above them, these sort of entrenched anchors, the executives, the publishers have become so terrified of the young people in their newsroom that go on social media and advance hashtags like the New York Times is killing Black people for publishing a Tom Cotton op-ed that they are now publicly signaling that they are in this camp as well. So what Chuck Todd, Kristen Welker, Mika Brzezinski, and these other sort of old guard news anchors were doing was saying, hey guys, we're part of your club. We also don't want, you know, right wingers on our channel. We're going to be on board with this fundamental transformation of the media. So this is now becoming a sort of bottom up process of the wokening of the media that is going to have obviously very huge consequences for the information diet that is fed to the American public. And I'm sure my co-hosts have plenty to say on this as well, but just one final point is that they obviously did not have a problem with other government stooges like George Stephanopoulos, Jen Psaki, and Simone Sanders being hired by the network. So this is very clearly a partisan issue, not whatever they claim it is, which is, I guess they're claiming that she is a mouthpiece for a certain political party and therefore can't be trusted to give her own opinion or be separate from whoever might be paying her.
Just to comment briefly on that, the reason I was chuckling is that there's kind of a pox on every house in terms of this story, because on the one hand, it's hilarious to watch the meltdown at NBC and MSNBC. How could you possibly platform a former RNC chair, et cetera? But then on the other hand, what does the former RNC chair do when she goes on? She challenges President Trump's vow to free the nonviolent J6ers and, you know, seek to create some redress for what has clearly been a political effort to railroad these people as representative of half the country as being actual or would be domestic terrorists, and use that to drive an entire war on wrongthink, the scaffolding it was all built on January 6th as the catalyzing event. But so she then attacks Trump on the network and those of us who have argued that J6 has been exploited to the hilt in a totally anti-constitutional, anti-rule of law way. And then there's also the insanity of, can anyone conceive of a DNC chair leaving to go to Fox News or Newsmax and then going on Fox News or Newsmax and saying, you know, I really think as a matter of justice, BLM rioters ought to be pursued by the DOJ to the same extent that J6ers were. It's obviously absurd on its face. You can't imagine that being the case. And what that shows is, you know, the former leader of the Republican Party, de facto leader of the party, qua party, is really a member of the uniparty at the end of the day. But you can't imagine a Democrat ever taking an analogous sort of position or doing what a head of the RNC would do. And this speaks to the sort of asymmetric scenario that we have between right and left. You can also see that obviously in terms of Bob Menendez sits as the Senate Foreign Relations Committee chair today, and George Santos is out, and Republicans barely have a majority to the extent they do have a majority on the House. So it just shows you the controlled opposition nature ultimately of much of the Republican Party. But even that is too far a bridge for NBC or MSNBC. Really quick, because I don't want to monopolize the time here, what I actually wanted to talk about briefly was just the UN Security Council resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire between Israel and Hamas, as well as the release of hostages and then the flooding of humanitarian aid, but not linking each of those factors. This as Israel labors to figure out the proper formula of multiples of jihadists to be freed in exchange for hostages, many of whom may be dead. And what did the U.S. do here? The U.S. abstained in response to this resolution instead of shooting it down. This comes on the heels of obviously Chuck Schumer effectively calling for regime change in Israel, speaking as a Jew effectively, not representing, of course, Jews in America or in Israel based upon the polls. And what this shows is that the Democrat Party bear hug that I've been speaking about for weeks is officially a mauling. And this is all part and parcel, not just of the politics of Democrats believing they need to win over the marginal Dearborn voter or the marginal voter in Minneapolis that they think is necessary to win in 2024, that is currying favor with the pro-Hamas or pro-Hezbollah voter in this country that is a contingent within the Democrat Party. But it's part and parcel of what I've called a shadow Iran nuclear deal. Israel is the biggest bulwark against a nuclear Iran, and Iran as the world's leading state sponsor of terror. That's why the Biden administration feels like the Obama Biden administration before it, that it has to put the screws to Israel and undermine it in every possible way. That's why it's throwing Israel to the wolves. So it's about more again than just the Michigan and Minnesota voter. It's a conscious foreign policy decision to try and impose a loss effectively on Israel, allow Hamas to survive and form part of a revitalized, quote unquote, Palestinian Authority government in what would amount to a Palestinian Arab terrorist state to be potentially unilaterally recognized by the Biden administration. And all of this ultimately makes the U.S. the world's leading state sponsor of the world's leading state sponsor of terror in Iran. I don't understand how anyone could see this as being in the U.S. national interest, and the Democratic Party has to answer for that.
Yeah, well, I guess I mean, two of my final thoughts got taken away right by you guys. Inez covered the bridge and Ben covered Israel. I'll talk mostly about what happened with the Israeli UN resolution. I've been listening to a lot of another very good podcast, Dan Senor's Call Me Back, where he's interviewing a lot of Israelis with basically like fluent English speaking Israelis. So it's an interesting podcast. You're getting a real sense of what the Israelis think about all this. And some of them have been, more bullish on Biden than others. They've said, well, Biden's actually provided us a lot of support, blah, 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 blah. But it's pretty clear that support is over if it ever was there. I think many of these are sort of the liberal Israelis who were, trying to hope that the Democrats in the White House would do what they wanted. It's not going to happen. And it certainly stopped. It's a shameful event. It really is. The fact that that Biden and his administration couldn't tell these ridiculous leftists to be quiet and that they're just enthralled them is just another reason friends don't let friends vote for Democrats. If you're a person who actually thinks Israel is in the right here and is against the kind of terrorism that we saw from Hamas on 10/7, Trump is the only option. You got to vote Republican.
And on that note, we're wrapping up for the week. On behalf of Amber, Will, and Ben, thanks for tuning in. I'm Inez Stepman, and I'll see you at the next NatCon Squad.